listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Kai Wright. Our images of psychedelic drugs come from a lot of places. Maybe pop culture depictions of them, or from scary tales told to us in high school health classes, or maybe even from our own efforts to break on through to the other side. But most of us don't know the real story behind these drugs and the promises they hold. Author and journalist Michael Pollan says there is growing interest in the therapeutic benefits of psychedelics. And he examines that shift in his latest book, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. It's published by Penguin, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael back to our show. Welcome.
Thank you, Kai. Very good to be here.
So you write that psychedelic drugs are having a renaissance. What's happening? What's going on? Why is this happening?
Well, there is a renaissance of scientific research. And, you know, to go back to your intro, I think you're exactly right that our image of these psychedelic drugs has been really shaped by the 60s and this very, what turns out to be a very anomalous period in their history. Mm. Long before Timothy Leary got a hold of LSD and psilocybin and started studying them at Harvard, there had been 10 years, a decade of incredibly promising research through the 50s and into the early 60s using these drugs to treat a variety of mental health problems, addiction, alcoholism in particular, depression, anxiety, obsession, and they were showing really good results as a therapeutic tool in mental health care. What happens in the 60s is the drugs kind of escape the lab and they fall into the hands or the arms of the counterculture. Right. And they end up shaping the counterculture in really important ways, I think, in terms of styles, mores, attitudes toward authority and the war in particular. They were one of the key ingredients in that stew that became what we call the 60s. And this led to a tremendous backlash. You know, President Nixon called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America, which is kind of amazing for a washed up psychology professor at that point, which is what he was at that point, on the run from the law. It became very hard for the researchers to continue. And the drugs became stigmatized. They became associated with insanity rather than mental health, ironically. And the media started hyping all these stories of people ending up in the hospital with psychotic episodes and jumping off of buildings and walking into traffic, most of which was urban legend. People definitely did get into trouble on psychedelics, but it was really exact. There was a moral panic, basically. And so the research stopped. Scientists are not very good at fighting political and cultural opprobrium. Mm-hmm. And they gave up the research at some point. Really, in the last therapeutic dose was given in the 70s, early 70s. And so we dropped this very promising line of research, which is incredible. I don't know when else in the history of science do you take something that scientists really believe in and think has a lot of potential to help people and let it die. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. And there was a 30-year hiatus.
You can think really only of maybe genetic cloning sort of 90s.
Galileo. I mean, you really have to go back to, to the Inquisition, I guess, when research was crushed. And these were very threatening drugs. They are disruptive in many ways. But we lost a lot of time and a lot of people who could have been aided by them.
Well, thinking about some of the perceptions for a bit before we get into the meat of the sort of therapy and research that can come from these, you opened the book talking about your own sort of shifting perceptions and relationships to this, and that, you know, you were sort of, you came along too late for the 60s counterculture, but just in time for the moral panic about it.
That's right. I'm much more a child of the moral panic. I had absorbed, I was Summer of Love in 1967. I was only 12, so I wasn't about to go to Haight-Ashbury or even to Woodstock. And I picked up on this fear of these drugs and the stories. Art Linklater's daughter had, he was a very important television personality. His daughter had jumped to her death from her apartment, and he blamed it on LSD, although there actually is no evidence that that was the cause. She had a lot of mental health problems. It became, kind of the focus where if something bad happened, you blamed LSD. Now, some bad things did happen. Charles Manson and his group was very involved with LSD, and that may well have affected his ability to essentially brainwash them. It is a very suggestible drug in the wrong hands. And the CIA, worked with it, of course, because they thought it could brainwash people. So I had absorbed all those lessons from, you know, health class that you're, you know, it would scramble your chromosomes, which was a study that was withdrawn almost as soon as it was published. And so I was too afraid to go near them. And I had virtually no experience with psychedelics until very recently, until I started working on this book. And, you know, I practice a kind of immersion journalism. And when I wrote about the cattle industry, I bought a steer. And so when I'm writing about psilocybin, I felt I couldn't really describe the experience without actually having it.
But it's interesting, I thought, you know, in talking about that, you sort of framed it as we think about these drugs as things we do in our reckless youth.
Yeah.
Certainly, that's how I did them, right? It was just pure pursuit of pleasure. Yeah. You know, whereas there might be something about them that is much more about things we do in our wizened middle ages.
I think that's a really good point. I say in the book at one point that I think psychedelics may be wasted on the young. I think they're most useful to us when we're kind of like getting stuck in patterns of thought and behavior. As we all get older, we develop these mental algorithms to deal with novelty, to deal with challenge, to deal with problems at work or in our families or whatever. You know, this is how you soothe a child. This is how you conduct a fight with your wife. This is how you deal with a challenge at work. And these habits are very useful, but they also blind us to novelty, to new experience, to sensory information coming in, to wonder. And that, it seems to me, is where these molecules can be very helpful. Rebooting the brain, as one of the neuroscientists said, allowing you to break out of what can be very destructive habits of thought or boring habits of thought and behavior. So, you know, many people had really important youthful experiences on psychedelics.
Sure.
But it's interesting that there, when you haven't totally formed your ego, dissolving your ego may not be the best idea. And for some people, they would get into trouble. But the more important distinction I think I would draw is between the guided psychedelic journey, which is how these drugs are used in a therapeutic context. And let me just briefly explain what that is. So you're working with someone who really knows the territory, who's used these substances and worked with many, many people who have. So they know what's likely to happen. They prepare you for the journey in advance. There's a meeting where they tell you what could happen. And they give you what are called flight instructions. This is advice if you really run into trouble. And at some point, you may well run into trouble. You might see a monster. You might feel yourself dissolving. And the advice basically comes down to surrender. Many guides quote John Lennon, relax your mind and let it float downstream. because it is, if you resist what is happening in your mind is when you get into that very dark, paranoid, frightened right. place. I mean, look, having your ego dissolve can be frightening or liberating depending on your mindset.
And these travel metaphors, it's always been part of it, but
yeah.
I hear it now when you're talking about it, even in a therapeutic model. Why is that metaphor so
well,
because
you're going somewhere you haven't been before. So in that sense, it is a kind of traveling. It's interesting, the trip as a metaphor was actually invented by, it was apparently proposed by someone in the military who was studying LSD. So things we think of as hippie metaphors are often not. In fact, Magic Mushrooms is the creation of a copywriter at Life magazine who was headlining an article about psilocybin in 1957. You know, the journey does seem right because you go places. You enter other states of consciousness. But there's also this intra-psychic movie that unfurls where you visit places in history or you may visit people who are dead. And it's narrative in that one thing happens and then another thing happens and then another thing happens. So it feels like, I mean, I guess story would be a good narrative
right.
too or movie. But the trip and travel and journeying really do seem to be where most people land in terms of coming up with a metaphor for the experience.
And you've mentioned psilocybin, right?
Psilocybin.
Psilocybin
yeah.
a couple times now. Let's define our terms. So when we're talking about psychedelics, we're talking about LSD, which I
yes.
think most people understand what that is. What psilocybin is what?
Psilocybin is magic mushrooms. Psilocybe is the name of this class of mushrooms. There are about 150 of them, and they create this very novel chemical that's closely related to both LSD and serotonin, which is the brain's own, you know, drug, I mean, neurotransmitter. And the effect of psilocybin, most of the researchers work with psilocybin now, not LSD, for the reason you just illustrated, because most people can't pronounce it. So there's much less likely to be some congressman getting up and complaining about psilocybin right. research compared to LSD research. LSD has a lot more cultural baggage.
Both remain baggage. Controlled substances.
They're in the same, they have the same status in terms of the law. They're both Schedule I controlled substances, which means under federal law that they have high potential for abuse and no recognized medical value.
Right.
In fact, they do have medical value that is increasingly being recognized. But just to go back for a second to the trip, after this preparation session, these guides, you wear headphones and you put on eye shades, so you have a very internal trip, and that's a real difference with the recreational trips that, you know, you were just alluding to. And they say very little. They basically let the journey unfold and take its own path, because if they said something, they could send you anywhere they wanted,
right.
pretty much, and they don't want to do that. They want you to go where your mind needs to go. And they sit with you, and they'll hold your hand if you need it, if you get really scared. But they're very non-interventionist. And then finally, they help you integrate the experience. You have a session with them, sort of like a psychoanalytic session, where you tell the story of what happened in your head, and you try to make sense of it. You try to find meaning in it. And that's really important, because these experiences can be very destabilizing. You know, most of us who have psychedelic experiences, as kids especially, but even as adults, if we're not being guided, we put this experience in a box labeled weird drug experience.
Right.
And it's not just that, though. It's not the product of the drug. It's the product of your mind stimulated by this drug. And it has lots of meaning. It explains things about you. So it's very important, I think, that you have someone to help you integrate the experience and make some sense of it.
And from a research perspective, part of it is that these drugs actually can help us understand our minds. Is that
yeah.
correct?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, you like a dream, is a product of your mind, easier to recall, which is an interesting thing about it. People don't forget their psychedelic trips, but of course we forget our dreams all the time. And it's got content. I mean, you can understand yourself. I mean, I find in some of my experiences for the book, I was able to connect with members of my family, with my parents. I had very profound experiences mm-hmm. with my parents and my relationship to them and my feelings about their mortality. So basically what's happening, as I understand it, is your defenses are lowering. Your ego defenses protect you from difficult internal material, unconscious material, and also strong stimulus from outside, things that you might regard as threatening. It's sort of like your brain's patrolman. And when your ego puts down its defenses, all sorts of stuff comes up. And you've opened doors, both to your internal state and your unconscious, your emotions, and also you've opened doors to things outside. You know, Aldous Huxley was right when he called this the doors of perception. And they are, actually Blake said it first, but they are opened wide. And so you're in a very vulnerable state. And in that vulnerability, it can be a great strength or it can be terrifying. And I think that's why the guide is so important.
You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm speaking with Michael Pollan about his new book, How to Change Your Mind. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm speaking with Michael Pollan about his new book, How to Change Your Mind, and the renaissance of research on psychedelics. So, Michael, how did this renaissance begin? Where did this come from?
Well, it really begins in the 90s. And that is, I mean, the earliest stirrings. And there was a group of really visionary people who were convinced of the value of psychedelics who were not scientists, interestingly enough. One was a tech engineer named Bob Jesse, who had worked at Oracle and had some powerful psychedelic experiences in the 90s and realized this is a really powerful tool for spiritual growth and enlightenment. Another was a man named Rick Doblin, who in college in the 80s had experiences with LSD and MDMA or ecstasy that convinced him he wanted to be a psychedelic therapist, that this could solve so many mental health problems, but they were illegal. And these two guys in America devoted themselves, hit their heads against the wall for decades to get this research restarted. Of course, there's no federal money for this research, and Big Pharma is not going to touch it because these chemicals are public domain at this point. And so these guys put together groups of scientists to work on it and helped fund the science. And so in the end, Rick Doblin focused on MDMA, and that work is proceeding apace. MDMA, or ecstasy, is used to treat people with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's showing remarkable success. About two-thirds of people, I think, in a recent trial who were struggling with trauma, either as sexual abuse victims or soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, found that there's a score for PTSD, that it went down all the way to the normal range, which is astonishing. And then on Bob Jesse followed another line, and he helped get start research at Johns Hopkins. And he got a very prominent scientist there who studied drug abuse mostly, named Roland Griffiths, to get interested in this. And they started a trial that was published in 2006. It was one of the strangest drug trials, I think, ever, where they tested to see whether a high dose of psilocybin could occasion a mystical experience in people and what that experience would be like. And they found that in about 80% of cases, it could do that, and that these experiences represented the first, second, or third most meaningful experience in these people's lives, comparable to the birth of a child or the death of a parent. How incredible that a molecule could do this. They also started using that experience, the mystical experience, to see if it might have therapeutic value. And they began giving, a few years later, they began giving the drugs to people with cancer diagnoses, people struggling with what they called existential distress, the fear and anxiety and depression that comes with a cancer diagnosis, whether it's terminal or otherwise, you know, life-threatening. And they found that the people in that group who had a powerful mystical experience completely were able to reset their thinking around death. And that in 80% of those cases, statistically significant decreases in standard measures of depression and anxiety. And this seems so surprising to me, so implausible, that that a molecule could change someone's whole mind, that that's when I decided I had to write a book about it and got involved with it. So talking to those volunteers, especially people who were dying, was inspiring.
And it's interesting because you're talking about a set of research that is sort of has two challenges. One, there's the fact that you're dealing with a substance that is illegal, not funded, and highly stigmatized.
Yes.
But then it's also, what I hear you describing is the research itself is about mysticism. You know, I mean, this, you know, you're trying to show the impact of mysticism. And how does that play out? I mean, is the point that the experience of the trip itself is the medicine, or is the point that there's something different happens in the physiology of our brains?
No, I mean, I think what's curious about this is a very unique approach to psychopharmacology or to psychology. You are administering an experience, as you suggested, not just a drug. And it is that experience that the drug occasions that seems to have the therapeutic value. That basically what is happening to people, as I understand it, and as I understand from my own experience in talking to them, that your ego on a high dose of psilocybin dissolves. You actually see yourself fall apart. And that can be a very scary experience, but if you surrender to it, it can be actually a very blissful experience. Because when your ego or yourself starts to dissolve, lots of other information flows in. You have this sense of merging with other people, with nature, with the universe. And a lot of what depression is about, and I think this is true for addiction too, is a sense of disconnection. The cancer patient feels really isolated. They are in this bag of bones that's gonna die, and that's themselves. And when you are able to merge with a larger entity, you suddenly realize that's not all I am. I am part of this community. I am part of this family. I am part of this universe. And that broadening of your concept of yourself and therefore your self-interest, I think, is what makes it somewhat easier to die. Mm-hmm. And that's an extraordinary idea. So it is it is treatment by experience. And we have nothing else like it.
And the volunteers you talked to who joined these who had these experiences, I mean, what drove them into it? How it seems
desperation,
like it's a big idea.
Desperation in many cases. I'll give you an example. There's one woman I talked to, a New Yorker in her 60s, a figure skating instructor, and she had ovarian cancer, and she'd been treated successfully, you know, had a course of chemotherapy, I think it was, or radiation, and yet she was so terrified by recurrence that she could not live her life. She could not resume her life.
She was physically healthy, but
she was physically healthy, but paralyzed. And she had this, she sought this experience at NYU, where this research was going on. And she went in her experience, she traveled into her body, and she saw under her rib cage this black mass. Wow. And she realized it wasn't her cancer, it was her fear. And she said to this, and I don't want to use this obscenity, but she said, "Get the F out." And when she screamed at it, it vanished. And she said, after that experience, it hasn't come back. She said, "I learned I can't control my cancer, but I can control my fear." And that changed her life.
Wow. And so how widespread is this research? I mean, is it just a couple of places? Or, I mean, where is this happening?
So the big centers of research so far have been right here in New York at NYU, at Johns Hopkins University. There's been very important research at UCLA as well, and at Imperial College in London. So far, these are the big centers of research. However, now that we're moving into phase 3 trials, which is the last step before approval by the FDA.
Which is the step where you try it on humans.
Well, no, we've been trying it on humans, but small groups. We've done phase 1, which is pilot study. Phase 2 is groups of about 40, say. And now phase 3 is going to be groups of hundreds. And this is where you really prove out, is this for real? Because in a small group, you have a little more control over selecting volunteers, and your guides are extremely well-trained and committed to the work. So phase 3, which should get started later this year, that will be 300 patients probably, and it will be at maybe a dozen sites. So there will be universities and medical centers all across the country doing this research, and it will be available to more people, which is very exciting.
Yeah. And does it then require FDA approval? Who approves this?
At some point, the FDA will say, yes, this has a medical use. We approve this, and then doctors can prescribe it. Well, there's one other step. The DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, has to reschedule it. Right now, it's Schedule 1. They have to move it to Schedule 2 or Schedule 3, which are potentially dangerous drugs that doctors can prescribe. Right. And at that point, you will have clinics that will be administering it. And people with a prescription from a psychiatrist, although they won't simply write a script that you take to the CVS, it will be in this guided environment.
Right, right.
So it'll be a very carefully regulated experience, as it should be.
But the research itself, does anyone have to say, okay, Johns Hopkins, you're allowed to do this research?
Oh, yes. They have to go through hoops to get this approved. They have to go through, there were 6 or 7 committees at Johns Hopkins, IRBs to protect the interests of the volunteers. The DEA has to give them permission to possess these drugs, which they have to keep in a safe and weigh every day to prove that they're not being abused.
And is there any concern that with the changing political landscape or with different administrations, be they federal or local, that the research would be shut down?
You know, so far the government has been remarkably supportive. The FDA, it's important to understand, we don't have a lot of tools to help the people that these drugs can help. Right. Antidepressants don't do the trick if you're facing your mortality. They're not even doing the trick for people with depression in many, many cases. Their effects fade, people don't like the side effects. So there's not a lot in the toolbox. And I think for that reason, the FDA has been, to my mind, remarkably encouraging of this research. Will it change with this administration? I don't know. You know, Rebecca Mercer, of all people, has donated a lot of money to this research.
Really?
Yeah, well, because it helps vets. So it's not the normal right-left split or cultural war split you might think. Steve Bannon has spoken out positively about this. And it is a form of deregulation. So,
right.
you know, I could easily see this administration getting behind it. And it will help with addiction, presumably, right, which is also a priority, supposedly, this administration. So, you know, there could be another backlash. There's no question. But I think the difference now compared to the 60s is that the people in charge of our institutions are not quite as freaked out by psychedelics, because a great many of them have had psychedelic experiences. I mean, I've talked to two past presidents of the American Psychiatric Association, both of whom had these experiences. You know, I'm sure there are regulators at the FDA who've tripped. And so you don't have that fear reaction that our elders had in the 60s, that what is this crazy medicine and what is it doing to our kids? They know the territory.
And the idea that what it was doing to our kids was making them anti-authoritarian, too.
Yeah, exactly. And that was very much a product of the times. I mean, these are disruptive chemicals. I think I can understand why, you know, the Catholic Church was very upset when they discovered mushroom cults in central Mexico, because these people had a sacrament that honestly was better than the Catholic sacrament. You actually got to see the gods and talk to them. You didn't need faith.
Right. Some guy up there telling you what it's like. You get to go yourself.
You don't need the priest, right? Yeah. I mean, you do circumvent authorities with these drugs. So the potential for a reaction is always there. And of course, somebody could be hurt. Thus far, there have been 1,000 volunteers who have been dosed with psilocybin in America. And there has not been a single serious adverse event. But if there is, you could see possibly some people turning against it.
We don't have a ton of time, but there's something called microdosing. I wonder if you could just quickly describe what that is.
Sure. Microdosing is the practice of using a sub-perceptual dose, usually of LSD, but possibly of psilocybin, every couple days as kind of a brain tonic. It's a seductive idea, but there's actually no evidence for it. Okay. No science has been done thus far, and everything we know about it is anecdotal. Anecdotally, people say it makes them feel better. It makes them more creative. But until research is done, we really don't know.
Got it. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking with Michael Pollan about his new book, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you, Kai.